My name is John Scott, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And that's by the grace of God and actions of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. I've been able to stay sober since December 19th, 1982. And for that, I'm awful grateful. And so is that one right there. I am really pleased and honored that you guys had asked us to come and share our stories. It's good that we get to do this together. We spent many years trying to kill each other, and now we get to enjoy a fellowship and a way of life that I never dreamed even possible. I mean, it's like you could tell me about this, but I wouldn't know what you're talking about. It's something you have to experience. It's something you have to experience. And one of the things that just seems to I get disappointed, I guess is the right word, whenever I see people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they leave just 5 minutes before the miracle, or the beginning of the miracle, or the beginning of miracles. It seems like there's a never-ending supply of miracles here, things that happen that shouldn't happen that better my life. And I just don't know how to express. How do you tell people what has happened to you whenever your entire life has changed in such a way that's truly wonderful? Now, don't get me wrong. There's days that if you come over to my house at 8 o'clock in the morning, you'd swear Cindy or I, either one, had ever been to a meeting of anything. You know, so we're not one of these people that everything's just always wonderful, but it's good. It's way better than it was, that's for sure. I want to thank the committee for asking us to do this together, and it's nice. I suppose I probably ought to talk about my drinking a little bit. I'm a commode hugging drunk. I like drinking. I like every part of drinking. I'm not against drinking. I like drinking, and I like it so much that I'm willing to give up almost everything to keep doing it. I was raised in a ranch, actually several ranches in southeastern Montana. My folks were in the ranching and farming business, I would go in the bunkhouse and I'd listen to these old cowboys. Most of them were World War II veterans, and they would tell these stories, these wonderful stories about going to town and getting drunk and having a great time with great ladies and all kinds of stuff, you know. And I'm about 8-9 years old, and I'm eating it up. And my mom would come in there and drag me off, and I'd feel embarrassed and humiliated. And you know, I can remember being humiliated and embarrassed almost from the beginning of my life. It seems like it's just a series of letdowns. And I remember one day we was moving a bunch of cattle down the Powder River, and it's a real dry country. And this guy in his pickup come driving by, and there's probably 8 or 9 of us moving these cattle. And this pickup waves everybody over, and so we all go over there. And he's got some beer, and he's got this beer in the back of his pickup, and this is before coolers and all that. And, you know, we got like a cardboard, or like a wooden box full of gunny sacks and maybe some ice in there that melted the day before. And these beers were hot. And anyway, I go over there to see what these guys are doing, and this one cowboy goes, "Here, kid, you want a beer?" And, man, I tell you what, I'm big stuff. This is big. I'm a big boy now. I get to drink some of that beer. And they use the church keys, you know, and open it up. And the next thing you know, I take this swig of this beer, and it gets right about here, and I can't do this crap, whatever it is. And all these guys have been lying to me because they told me how wonderful beer was, and I can't. I mean, this is something that tastes like it just come out of that horse that I was riding, you know. It's like, my God, you know, why would you do this to yourself? And about 10 years later, I found out why. It was something that changed the way I felt from head to toe. I mean, I was always a misfit. I always felt like I was just a knothead. You know, people would seem to know things that I didn't know, but I thought I should know it. And I can remember when I was going to school. I was just in grade school, and I remember walking these two kids, these older kids behind me, and they said, "Look at him. He walks funny." I didn't know it, but for the next 4 or 5 years, I could not walk right. I would try to walk right. I'd try to get it down, and then I'd fall over myself or something, you know. But you give me a few beers, and not only can I walk, I can swagger. There's alcoholics in here, I bet, that can swagger too, even when they're not drinking. But I could go up to a gal and ask her to dance, and if she said no, I was not suicidal. I would just go to the next girl and ask her to dance until finally somebody would do it, you know. It changed everything for me. And from time to time, people would say, John, you need to learn how to drink. I thought I knew how to drink because I could outdrink anybody. You know, you want to talk about drinking? Let's get after it. Let's do some serious drinking. You know, I'm not talking about a couple hours. I'm talking about a couple of days. Let's get after it. You know, and they'd say, you need to learn how to drink. I know how to drink, for crying out loud. And it finally got to the place where I had to do something about it. But boy, I tell you what, we don't learn fast. I don't anyway. I'm a slow learner. I was working on these ranches for my dad, and me and him kind of had a falling out. So I showed him. I joined a rock and roll band in the mid-60s. And the mid-60s, you know, people say if you remember the 60s, you wasn't there. Well, that's not exactly a lie, because it's a lot of my drinking that I have no idea in the world what happened. And, you know, it's mostly hearsay. And, you know, I hate waking up with those folks. You know, you wake up in the morning, you know how we wake up, it's kind of like somebody drowning and you're coming out of the water, and it's like, what the hell did I do last week? You know, what is it? And you got to go ask them. You got to ask them. You know, you don't want to ask them. I mean, how do you ask somebody about what you did and you don't know that they don't know that you don't know? You know, you really kind of got to work at that. That causes friction in your life if you don't. And you end up with all this. It's just like this. It starts out as the low-grade chaos in your life. Just not all the time, but it's just like almost all the time you get to where it's just, you know, maybe you get thrown in jail, or maybe they start pulling you over way more than they should. And I mean, all this kind of stuff, just, and you can't hold a job, you know. And one of the reasons you can't hold a job is because you don't show up, but that's a mystery to me. And, you know, how do you hold jobs, you know? And I'm really a good worker when I'm there, you know. And you just, you know, you kind of float through life, and it doesn't really, you know, things aren't really as serious as people think they should be, you know. And I'm sitting there playing one night at this dance, and this gal who stands right about where she is right now, and she just standing there just looking at me, and I'm playing my guitar, and you know, the first set she just stands there the whole damn set, she's looking right at me, and so. We go out to the car during the break and do whatever it was we was doing that night, and come back, and there she is again, standing. And so now we're in this double dare stare deal, and where, you know, who's going to blink first, and that doesn't work. And we go to our next break, and anyway, the third set, same thing. I thought, you know, this is going to be a great night. We're going to have some fun tonight, that's for sure. And as soon as the dance was over, I run out to the front door, and I'm watching, and I don't see her. So, you know, that's just the way things go. So the next morning, we go down to this place to get our equipment that we played the night before, and we stopped at this light, and right across the street is a friend of ours, and we wave him over, come on, and hop in the car with us. And he runs across the street, and I didn't see this until she got there, but she was right behind him. She thought we was waving at her, you know, and next thing I know, she's sitting right next to me in this car, and I have never been able to get rid of her since, because she's still there. So. And I want you to know, we fell in love. I mean, big time. I mean, we were infatuated with each other. And I mean, it was just great. She's going to tell her story tomorrow, but this is my time. I get to tell my story. And you want to be careful what they say, because they can remember it. I can't remember what I had. You know? So anyway, we're just infatuated with each other, and we're going along. And about a year later, she says, "I got something I got to tell you," and I could tell her she's really serious, because, you know, She says, "I got to tell you something." I says, "You remember when we first met each other?" And I says, "Yeah." And he says, "Remember, I was 18 and you was, 20, I think?" "Yeah, yeah." "Well, I was not 18, I was 13. Well, that's what I said. Whoa, yeah. Oh, and she's got a sense of humor on top of everything. It's like, shoot, this is black. I said, nah. She says, no. And I said, no. And she says, yeah. And I'm going, oh, crap. You know, I said, I'm not going to buy this. I'm going to go talk to your mom. And so I go talk to the mom who, she thought I was one of her as long as I was drinking. When I got sober, she didn't even like me a little bit, you know. But I'm going up to her and I'm saying, you know, what's the deal here? And she says, yeah, she's 13. That means when I start going with her, she's 12, you know. And I thought, my God, this is it. I'm done. I told her, I says, I'm through. I am done. I love you dearly, but we've got to break this off. And I left her for about a week. And not only am I an alcoholic, but I'm kind of brain dead too when it comes to I don't know what they do here in Florida, but in Montana, I think they just hang you for hanging around with a 12-year-old. So anyway, but she turned 18, we went down to Wyoming because you can marry somebody in Wyoming if you got a parent's consent. And so her mom come down with us and she was 16, and in about 4 seconds we got married. And it's pretty good. I mean, we had a pretty good life. I went back to work for my dad, and I ended up running a pretty good size feed lot, and we were pretty happy for quite a while. But you know, alcoholism just kind of takes hold of you little by little. It's like the frog in the pot thing. It's just that little increment change, you know, and all of a sudden the whole perception of how I lived just starts to decay just a little at a time. And I didn't even realize it. I didn't realize what was going on. After about 12 or 13 years, the book calls him Mr. Brown showed up in our life. You know, if you haven't read the book, Mr. Brown's not a good guy. He's not a good guy. He's causing a lot of resentments and fear and anger. And I got crazy as a loon. I'm drinking pretty good now. This is about 13 years into my marriage, and I don't know how long into my drinking, but it's I'm going along, and I'm not a happy camper. I'm crazy. I get crazier and crazier. I begin to think about suicide. I begin to think about homicide. It just, you know, I had the mind of a new guy. You know, every 15 seconds it's something new, and I'm going along there. I don't know whether I want her to leave or whether I just want her to kill her. You know, I mean, I was in love with her. I mean, I put her up on an unhappy marriage to say the least. But we're both pretty arrogant people, and neither one of us, it's like if you blink first, you lose. So we're hanging on to each other, but we're going to, you know, and she would do these goofy things like try to kill me. I'm not going to get into that too much, but she tried to freeze me to death more than once. And it's like you just do these things, and looking back on you, you say, well, that was a red flag. But at the time, I didn't even see the flag. I mean, I'm just brain dead sometimes. It got to where, you know, I don't know what to do or anything. I don't have any idea that I'm an alcoholic. I never heard of AA until probably the last 4, 5, 6 months prior to getting here. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a lot of drunks that worked for us on that wagon, you know, on the ranch in the wagon, but I never knew anything. I didn't know about AA. I just thought that, you know, they talk about people with a craving. Well, I thought they'd come up to the bar, a little foam coming out of their mouth. I got to have a drink, you know, and that ain't the way I did it. I just walked in. Red was the bartender, and I say, hey, Red, give me the normal. And he says, yeah, okay, two at a time. Keep them coming. That's right, Red, that's right. You know, Red knew what I wanted. I get just goofier, and heck, I begin to have a gun, and I'm sticking it in my mouth, and I'm going to pull the trigger because I can't stand life anymore. And then one night, I don't know, I got to thinking, you know, she wasn't always home. We would have these legendary moves. We would take all of her stuff and throw it in these glad bags, throw it in the back of my pickup, drive to her mom's house, and throw them out on the lawn. And going to mom's house was something else, too, because, heck, you don't know what's going to happen over there. There might be two or three of them out there fighting right there in the yard. That happened all the time. So, and then across the street was a guy that I was to sponsor later, and he says, God, you guys kept me entertained all that summer. He says, you could always tell which way he was going. Else he was going out with the glad bags over the top of the pickup, or else you'd come in there with the Samsonites, and, you know, we're going back, and we're going to love each other forever. And, I mean, one week I'd be together, and the next week we'd be separated, and it's just, you know, just high, high drama every single day, you know. And you'd think I loved it because of the way things were working, but I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. And it began to dawn on me, shoot, I'm killing the wrong person. I'm not, it's her fault that I'm like we are, and I need to get her too. And so then I got to thinking, you know, those kids, what kind of deal would it be with those kids if those kids knew that their dad took their mom out and then killed himself? And there's a doctor in our town that did exactly that just a few months after I got sober. So I understand that type of insanity. I was beyond human aid, and I absolutely had the inability to think straight. I couldn't think straight if my life depended on it, which it did. And I don't know what to do, and I don't know how to live, and I don't know if I'm going to make it through this period of time. And there's a guy who's a feed store salesman. His name was Frank, and Frank was my drinking buddy. I mean, Frank and I could drink for days. And Frank came out one day, and I says, Frank, it's about noon, and I poured myself a drink, and I poured Frank a drink, and I pushed it across the table. I says, here, Frank, have a drink. Frank says, John, I ain't drinking today. And I'm like, you know, this is real, something's wrong with Frank. You know, he's, come on now, you know. He says, no, I ain't drinking today. And I mean, it's about noon, and about 3 o'clock it began to dawn on me that maybe Frank ain't drinking today. I'm an obnoxious kind of a drunk. If you don't want to have fun with me when I'm drinking, I'll have fun with you while I'm drinking. So I'm sitting there holding Frank. And I can't figure out how I kept him there until, you know, early afternoon. And years later, we were talking about it. He says, well, it's pretty easy. He says, you'd be sitting there and you'd be talking to me, and I'd say, I gotta go. And I'd say, no, you don't gotta go. And he says, yeah, I gotta go. And I'd just pull out my gun and say, sit down. And I said, well, what did you do? And he says, I sat down. So I says, I didn't do that. I would not ever think of doing that. He says, yeah, you did. I was there. He says, I'm the only one that's sober, and I was there, and you did that. And I go, oh my God, you know. And but I didn't know that until I was, what, 20 years sober. You know, so I keep hearing these pieces of information. I got to assume that most of them are true, but I just can't imagine myself doing that. I can't imagine myself sticking a gun in my mouth. I can't imagine myself thinking the way I was thinking, but that's what happened to me. That's how deep my alcoholism took me, to the point that I was willing to destroy my life or others. And it wasn't a passing thought. This is the thing about it. It wasn't a passing thought. It began to be an obsession. And so I'm asking Frank, you know, what's so damn important that you can't have a drink with me? He finally fesses up. He says, well, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous for the last several weeks. Alcoholics Anonymous? My God, Frank, you drink just like I do. And he goes, yeah, I know. And I said, well, you know, I've been having a lot of trouble at home. You know, Cindy's running around with that guy, and you know, I'm crazy as a loon, and I don't know. I don't know. Maybe could you take me to a meeting? He says, no. I said, no. He says, no. He says, I ain't taking you to a meeting. He says, Alcoholics Anonymous are for people who quit drinking. You're still drinking, obviously, so keep drinking. And I can remember waking up that next morning going, oh, my God, this drinking is getting out of control. I almost went to AA last night. Jeez. I can't believe what's happening to me. And for the next 6 months, I don't have any flashy thing. My story is just kind of like Alcoholic 101. I mean, every day was just a little worse than yesterday. And tomorrow's going to be a little worse than today. And I don't know what to do or what to say. And I feel like I'm a misfit because I am a misfit. I feel like there is no honor in myself. I have no way in the world to keep my word with anybody about anything. I cannot. I will not participate in anything that might help you because it's all about me. But I don't know it's all about me. It's just what's going on. And I get to a place where I'm beyond human aid. There's nothing there to help me. There is nothing or nobody can help me. I can remember I can remember during that period of time, I went down to the mailbox. We had like 20 mailboxes lined up, and I don't even know why I was going to get my mail. I hated to get the mail. I hated to answer the door or get the mail. The mail, they just want their money. That's all, you know. They want money, and I'm not, you know. And you'd throw those in the wastebasket. And my mom drove up next to me, and she says, "John, how you doing?" And I told her, I says, I'm crazy as hell, but I'm going to be all right, you know. I'm going to be all right." And she says, "Well, I just worried about you. I'm worried about you." And I says, "You know what happened the other day, though? Somebody came into our house and took all my guns." And I says, "I don't know who it was." And she, you just tell, because when I could tell when my mom had something going on. And she says, "Well, your dad and I, we're really afraid for you." And so we went over to get those guns, and we got them, and we got them in safekeeping. And I can remember going, "Oh, Mom, if I'm going to use a gun, I'm using this one right here." You know? And I can remember that look on her face, and we've all seen that look. It's like, oh, what do you do? You know, what do you, how do you communicate to somebody who's as messed up as that? How do you even begin, you know? And the look of despair. And I just drove off. Didn't even faze me at all. At least I knew where my guns were. You know, if I need them, I'll go steal them back. But I had the one that I wanted. And I was just terrified of living anymore. I was more worried about staying drunk at some point than I was about staying sober. And I had no idea that my problem was not drinking. My problem was sobriety. And it was just beating me down to a point where I was willing to do about anything but quit drinking. Don't want to do that. But I remember waking up on December 18th, the day before I got sober, and I woke up in that house, and it was a house that I, you know, how we are when you first wake up, you have no idea where you're at. It was December 18th, and the last I remember was Thanksgiving. And there's a space there, you know, and it's like, they said I had fun, I guess. I don't know. I just remember little pieces, little tiny pieces. But I remember waking up that morning and just, you know, you got to ask those questions about where was I, what did I do, and not let them know that you don't know about you. And I was lucky. I was with this guy named Johnny. He's an old man. He's probably 50, 52 years old. And he'd been the guy that I was drinking with. I'd ran all my other friends away. We talked a little bit about what had gone on over the last couple of weeks. And I said, I got to go see Frank. I said, he knows about that AA thing. I don't know nothing about it. Well, let's go over and talk to Frank about this. So we did. And Frank was just excited to see us. You know, I mean, he's just wound up, ready to go. We're sitting outside in my Suburban, and we're having a few beers, because when I drink like I drink, I get really, really nervous, and I'm just shaking like a leaf. He gets out there. He's got the 20 questions. Have you guys seen these 20 questions? I mean, now I think it's like 40, but at that time it's 20 questions, and you cannot cheat, even though you cheat. And I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to answer these things, and it says if you get one wrong, you might be. If you get two wrong, you probably are, and three, you're screwed. And I've got like 16 out of the 20, and I tried to work my way through that thing to where nobody, you know, it says that you're probably an alcoholic. And I'm going, well, Frank, would you take us to a meeting? Johnny and I decided that maybe we want to join this AA thing. And he says, no. Now I've had guys come up to me after I get through talking, and they said, that's not right. And I agree, it's not right, but this is what happened. You know, when you tell a story, you can tell it however you want. But I sat there and I couldn't believe that he went, but I was kind of relieved. You know, he says, I'll tell you what you do. He says, if you and Frank, or you and Johnny don't have a drink the rest of the day, that's fine. But if you want to drink, drink. Well, it's Saturday. You know, I mean, Saturday. You can't quit on Saturdays. And so anyway, we come up with this deal. You know, okay, if you go ahead and drink today all you want, but tomorrow don't drink, I'll take you to a meeting tomorrow night. So, I mean, that sounded okay for me, even though as goofy as I was, so... I ended up drinking the rest of that day. And I always want to, you know, we talk about remembering our last drink. Well, I like to remember my last drink. It was really wonderful. I'd sit over in the corner and I'd cry because I was alone and lonely. And then you'd come over and want to talk to me, and I'd want to fight you. And then you'd leave, and then I'd be over there crying because I was alone and lonely. And that's basically what I did the whole day, you know. And I ended up by some miracle, I ended up not drinking that next day. Now, Frank would call Cindy and tell her to make sure that I didn't drink, and she would hang up on him. Because Cindy had gotten to where she was very rude. Very, very rude. The year before, we had a New Year's Eve party. This will give you some kind of little... We had this New Year's Eve party. We invited all of our friends from all the neighboring ranches to come over. And, of course, it's a bring-your-own bottle. I'm not going to buy yours. But anyway, we had this party, and it's New Year's. It's midnight, and it's the new year. And Cindy's upstairs, and we have this linoleum floor over the top of our bar. And she's up there running a vacuum cleaner over the top of this linoleum floor, and it's not like a woodchuck or a wood cutter, you know. And she's got the dishwasher going, she's got the dryer going, she's got the washing machine going. And this lady, this neighbor of ours, says, "My God, she's busy." And I says, "Yeah, she's a little twisted off, you know." And she wouldn't answer the door, and if she did, she'd just open the door and walk over. You know, nobody liked her. I was stuck with her, and. You know, if you had a wife like mine, I had something that had more meaning than the normal. You know, this is really not good. And so, anyway, Frank would call Cindy up and say, "Don't let him drink," and she'd hang up on him. So I got in my pickup that night and I drove into that. Frank had gotten hold of me and told me to come over to a restaurant across the street from where the meeting was. And so I walked over there, and this guy named Johnny. Or Johnny, this guy named Frank was Richard's, I'll get this right. My friend Frank introduced me to his sponsor, Richard. And Richard wore a three-piece suit and wingtip shoes and smoked cigarettes just like this, just constantly smoking cigarettes. That last night speaker was talking about that smoke. We had so much smoke in the smokers didn't even like our room, you know, because you couldn't see across it. But anyway, he's smoking these cigarettes like they're just going out of style. And he asked me these trick questions because I know this is an elite group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been trying to get into it for 6 months now. And I asked him, he asked me, he said, "John, do you feel like you're responsible for your own actions?" And I can remember my mind just going, you know, because I don't know what the answer is, because this has got to be the right answer or else they're not going to let me in. And I remember going, "Well, yeah, I think I am." And he says, "Well, good, maybe you'll start acting like it." And I'm going, "Wow, how does he? I bet he's been talking to Frank, who's been talking to Cindy, just sure as heck." You know, and anyway, he talked to me a little bit about his life and told me about his life story and about how he had been a high up in General Motors. And when he went, the only thing I remember is when he went to Las Vegas, he didn't rent a room, he rented a floor. You know, and I'm, whoa, you know, just stuff like that always tipped me over. So anyway, he was like a no-nonsense type of guy. He wasn't really all that happy, I didn't think. But anyway, we went across to the meeting, and I don't know who spoke that night. I've talked to people who knew who was basically there, but I don't know what was said. But the only thing that I kind of gathered out of that meeting was that there is a bunch of people here who don't drink anymore, and they used to drink all the time. That's pretty much what I heard. And there's all paid counselors. I mean, I have the secret weapon. It's this gray stuff between my ears that knows things it's not true. But I just love to believe it anyway. So I get to thinking, you know, this is just Alcoholics Anonymous. With a name like that, you've got to be hurting for membership to begin with. That's why you made that test that nobody can pass, you know. And so anyway, I get to this meeting, and I don't know. The very first night, a guy named Johnny says, "You don't have a sponsor, and I need to sponsor somebody, and I'll be your sponsor." And I didn't know, you know. I thought the sponsor was the guy who was paying your way or something, or you're just going to have to pay his way or something. There's money involved, short story. So he took me to his house that night, and he introduced me to his wife and his kids, and you know, Dad's been sober now for 7 years, and life is pretty good. And he invited me to invite Cindy to come to meetings. And so I'd go back home, and this is one of those rare times that Cindy was back home, not at her mother's, and I'd say, "Well, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous," and she'd go, "Good." You know, and I'd say, "They'd like to have you come along." "No." So that was pretty much it. But he says, you keep asking her. So I'd keep asking her, and I'd keep asking her. And in the meantime, Johnny started getting, you know, I've got about, 30, 40 days, maybe 45 days of sobriety behind me. And Johnny starts acting really weird. I mean, Johnny starts saying things like, calling me up in the middle of the night, John, you need to get in here. We lived out on the ranch at the time. He says, you need to get in here. They're out in the car, and I can see them, and they're going to get me. And I'm going, Johnny, I can't make it tonight. I'm sorry, you know, and I'd hang up. And two or three nights later, he'd call me up and say, John, you got to get in here. You really got to help me. They're in the closets now, and I know they're going to get me. And I said, Johnny, I can't help you. I can't do that. And this is when we had the old black phones with rotary. So I'd hang up the phone, and then the phone would ring. This was long before caller ID. And I'd pick up the phone. It's one of Johnny's guys. He's sponsoring about three or four of us. And I'd answer the phone, and it'd be one of his guys, and he'd say, Charlie, you talked to Johnny tonight? And I said, yeah, he's a little twisted off. A little twisted off ain't the right answer, but yeah, he's crazy as a loon. And I'd go talk to the old guys in the group and say, you know, this is what's happening. And they say, yeah, he's gotten mad at his group, and he's gotten mad at his sponsor, and he's not willing to do anything, and he's really in bad trouble. And, you guys need to be doing something. I said, we can't do nothing here. He's not willing to do anything. You just stay close to us. And a few days later, Johnny went out and got drunk, you know. And it taught me a good lesson that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fragile thing. Sobriety here is a fragile thing. And I don't care if you're here 7 days, 7 years, or 70 years. It don't make any difference. Our thought process is not right. It's not right. And now if you're new here, I don't want to hurt your feelings. Just out of curiosity, how many people are here less than a year? Oh, good, good. We want you to know that we're really, really glad you're here. And that speaker last night, Billy, did a good job. If you hadn't heard that, that was a good talk last night. And one of the things he said, or I don't know if he said this or not, but I was just thinking, they say this about people in AA, you know, the new ones are the most important ones in the room. Not even close. Sorry. If I ain't here, who cares, you know? I mean, it's a selfish program. That's what they said. So, anyway, I forgot where I was. I'm glad that the new folks are here. I really am. I hope you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. I hope that you're finally to a place where you'll begin to realize that it might be to your benefit to listen to somebody else. Of course, if your deal's really working, I wouldn't change a thing. You know, so I ended up, understanding that time wasn't everything for us. You know, we get this little thought process going. I've been to so many meetings. I sponsor so many people. I've held so many offices. I've been sober for so long that we begin to think we're exempt. And I got to tell you, there's two guys that I sponsored this year, and neither one of them was exempt, and both of them had over 20 years of sobriety, and one of them stuck a gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Yeah, and it happens all. I can remember my first sponsor, or not my first sponsor, but Richard. He told me, he says, you know, listen, this is a matter of life and death. And I can remember looking at him in the eyes and going, you old fool, you've been here too long. And I got to tell you, he was telling the truth. So my sponsor, Johnny, went out and got drunk. So that night, I go back to the meeting. And I knew I needed to pick a new sponsor. And there's this little blonde over there that I had spotted. And she had what I wanted, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And I was on my way to ask her, and this Richard, this Frank sponsor, walks out in front of me and says, John, I'm sorry to hear about your sponsor. You need a sponsor, so I'm going to be him. Now, I didn't get to pick Johnny to begin with, and I was kind of feeling a little put out about that, because there's people in that group that got to ask, and I didn't get to ask. And now Frank is telling me, and he always knew what I needed. He was a used car salesman, and a couple of weeks later, he sold me a diesel that he insisted that I really wanted. So, and the crazy thing about Richard is Richard was in Montana, and I got sober in Billings, Montana. He was in Montana, his wife was in California, and he was in Montana to teach her a lesson. I'm not sure what the lesson was, but So anyway, he's my new sponsor. And thank God, because he was instrumental in my sobriety, because he knew when I was lying, he knew when I was telling the truth. He was one of those kinds of guys for me. And you know, at first I really liked AA. I really did. But if you're new here tonight, and I'm sure that this has probably not happened but to one or two of you, but I begin to see the flaws in those old people's characters. I mean, there was some, you know, I mean, there's Margaret, who was, oh, God, Margaret was, you know, I don't even know why they'd call on Margaret, because Margaret would say the same thing over and over and over again. It's like, hi, my name is Margaret, and I'm an alcoholic, and then to go to a meeting, stay sober, and then don't thank you very much. It's like, Jesus, don't call on Margaret, for crying out loud. Because you call on her next week, she's going to say, hi, my name is Margaret, and I'm an alcoholic, and them to go to meetings, stay sober, and them to don't. I mean, no message at all. Nothing. There's just nothing there. And then there's Millie. Millie's a little old grandmother-type gal. She's sitting in her chair. The world was kind of right when she was in her chair. And she'd say, John, come over here and sit next to me. And I'd sit next to her, and she'd pat me on the leg. And she'd say, John, just look at all the miracles. And I'm going, I don't see any miracles, Millie. She'd say, John, you keep coming back until you can see the miracles. No, you know, come on, that's lame. And then there's this guy named Gerald, and Gerald was a guy who'd just gotten out of the nut house in Montana there about a year or so before. And Gerald would come up to you and ask you, how you doing? And I'd tell him. I mean, he asked me how I was doing, so I'd tell him. And I'd tell him, and he'd say, shut up. He'd say, now listen to me. When I come up to you and I ask you how you're doing, I want you just to say, you know, I'm doing all right. You don't have to give me your life story, okay? He says, I want you to look me in the eye. I want you to shake my hand. I want you to say, why, Gerald, I'm getting better in every way, every day. Thank you very much. Now, I haven't been here very long, but I know this is an honesty program, and Gerald's trying to make me lie because I'm not getting better. You know, and then there's this guy named Rotten Ralph. Rotten Ralph was a lawyer. He was an attorney. He'd gotten AA for stealing semi-trucks down the road drunk. And Richard was gone. You know, Richard told me not to talk in meetings. He says, you only know how to be sick. You don't know how to be well. You need to shut up and listen. So if they call on you, John, what you say is, hi, my name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you very much, and I pass. He says, that's all you need to know, because you don't have any solution whatsoever. But if he was gone, I might say a few words. And invariably, if I said something, they would call on Rotten Ralph right after. And Rotten Ralph would just, I mean, he was one of those old guys that could just tear you apart with 15 words or less. You know, I mean, you're cut and you don't even know it for a half hour. And I'm going, oh, crap. And then when he'd get all done, he'd reach in his pocket and pull out his dollar that he was going to give to the plate. And he said, now, if I made you so damn mad you think you got to have a drink, here, let me buy you your first drink. And I said, what happened to love and tolerance, for crying out loud? And then there's this guy named Nick. Nick was a counselor from down in Denver, and he moved back up to Billings. And all the old guys thought that Nick just hung in the moon. And Nick's deal was, well, if you're not here a year, there's actually no reason in the world for me to remember your name. And what happened to just welcome? You know, come on. And Frank and I were sitting on the couch one night, and we were discussing how our wives had gone bad. And Nick comes up, Nick comes up behind us and says, well, pour me another drink. You know, I can remember Frank and I looking at each other going, what the heck was that? You know? So after I'd been sober for about 6 months or so, I remember one night I thought, you know, I'm going to get that doggone Nick. I'm going to get him where he remembers my name. And so I went up to him in my very best newcomer voice. I could say, Nick, you got a minute? And Nick says, sure, which surprised me. So anyway, we go over and sit on the couch, and I start telling Nick about how Cindy's been screwing me over for the last 13 years. And he says, oh, shut up. He says, I am so sick and tired of you. We all are so sick and tired. I don't know why they was ganging up on me, but he says, We're so sick and tired of you. Says, you kind of have to remember something. I don't care about that crap. Only thing I want to know is, what are you going to do about your drinking? That's the only thing I want to know about. He says, because you're wasting everybody's time doing anything else. If you want to get drunk, for Christ's sake, just go get drunk. And I remember, this is it. I am done. I'm quitting AA forever. And I got up, and he's a crippled up old man. I get up, and I'm leaving. And he gets up to me, and he pushes me up against the wall. He says, listen, you. He says, you're wasting my time, and you're wasting their time, and you're damn sure wasting your time. Now, if you want to get out of here, just leave. And don't come back, because we don't need you, but you do need us. And over his shoulder comes Rotten Ralph. And let me buy you a first drink. Let me buy you a first drink. You know, it's like, oh, yeah. It's like, man, that ain't no way to treat anybody. I mean, I stumble outside and I get in my diesel car that my sponsor sold me that I really wanted, and I'm spinning gravel, you know. But this is an old diesel. It's not like they have today. And you step on it and go, I mean, 20 miles from now I'll be 20 miles an hour, maybe, you know. And so anyway, I'm thinking I'm spinning gravel, and no gravel's getting spent. So I show them the signal, you know, and I drove them past. And I'm going home, and it's like I'm just screaming, and I'm hollering, and I'm beating the dash, and I'm honking the horn, because I'm spoiled brat, that's what I am. And it's something just like that just hit me, and it's like, so I'm an alcoholic. What am I going to do about it? Maybe for the first time in my life, I'll start listening to somebody else, give myself some kind of a break. Maybe I'll start to pay attention to what's going on in my own damn life. I don't know about you, but I cannot believe how unconnected to me I was when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I also liked you, or I didn't. End of story, you know. And there's a very fine line between the two of them. So I remember just fighting my head all of that next day. God, I don't, you know how we are. We always got something we got to do. And I'm trying to find something to do, but there's nothing. The only thing I can think of is I got to go back to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting again tonight. So I get in my diesel car that my sponsor sold me. And I'm driving back, and I'm going, geez, I hate this idea. Yeah, they're going to call on Margaret. Sure as heck. And then Millie will want me to sit next to her. Oh, yeah, hi, Gerald. He'll be at the door. You know he will. He'll be at the door. Hi, Gerald. Yeah, I'm really doing good, you know, getting better in every way every day. Thank you very much. Lie through my teeth, you know. And then it dawned on me, you know, maybe I am. Maybe I am getting better. And got to give Nick back his damn dollar. Just humiliating stuff like that right off the bat, you know. And then I go up to Nick and I say, Nick, could I talk to you a little bit? I want to apologize for my poor behavior last night. I says, I really do. I says, I was wrong. And he puts his hands on my shoulders and looks me right in the eye. He's, John, I'm going to tell you something. And I mean, I'm choking up because this is the kindest he's ever been to anybody in his entire life. He says, you're a good man. And he says, you know why I know you're a good man? I'm breaking down crying at this point because, I mean, I don't know what to say. I because I don't cry, I just slobber and throw things. And, just, and he says, you know why I know you're a good man? And I go, no, Nick, I don't. He says, it's because everybody is born with the same amount and you haven't used a damn bit of yours yet. I'm just like, oh. It's like, don't they ever give up? It's just... But I am so thankful for those folks because they literally saved my life. Because I'm the kind of guy, if you'd have patted me on the back, I'd have gone. I'd have ran. But they seemed to have my number, and they seemed to understand the nature of the illness that I had. And the thing that I forget to say every once in a while is that about a year later, this Native American girl comes back to the meetings, and she says, where's Nick? And I says, well, by this time, Nick had died. He had cancer. He had cancer when he was talking to me, and I didn't know that. Never knew about it until he died. And he says, you know, she says, you know what Nick did? And he says, you know what Ralph and Nick did to me one night? And she told me my story. And I thought, those guys knew something about what they were doing, you know. Now, that wouldn't work on everybody, but it certainly worked on me. And I began to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous little by little. Things changed. I was going to meet, she wasn't, I was going to meetings, and she was getting better. You know, that's a weird deal. I mean, that's freaky. And anyway, Richard asked me, he says, how's your relationship with, well, he knew how it was, because I'm telling everybody every second I get. If you'll listen, I mean, it got to where I couldn't even get close to an old timer because they'd already heard it so many times. So I said, well, I'm getting a divorce. And he says, now, wait a minute, I want to understand something. You're the one who's getting a divorce? And I says, yeah, I'm getting a divorce. I spent a lot of money on it so far, too. He says, well, you'll quit that right now. I said, what? He says, yeah, you'll quit. I said, she's crazy. Oh, yeah. He says, sure, she's crazy. She's got to be crazy. Anybody live with you for 13 years got to be plumb out of her mind. He says, but you don't know how to have a relationship. He says, well, she's there, and we're going to practice on her because you can't hurt her. And you're going to go home, and you're going to tell her that you love her. Got me lying again, because I don't even like her. He says, I know you're a liar, and she knows you're a liar, and you're probably going to figure it out one of these days that you're a liar. He says, what I want you to do is I want you to show her that you love her. And I can remember my ears went up like that, and he says, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about that. He says, what I'm talking about is I want you to do the dishes every once in a while. I want you to make up the bed every once in a while. I want you to pick up yourself, your clothes after you take a shower. He says, I want you to start treating her with kindness and respect. I want you to really work at treating her with kindness and respect. I don't want you to ever tear her down in public or in private. Always build her up. And don't tell her what she's doing wrong. And I said, well, who's going to tell her? He says, I don't know, but it ain't going to be you. And so little by little it changed, you know, and we started doing the steps and got to the fourth step inventory. And I don't know if this has ever happened to any of you, but your spouse standing in the doorway not wanting you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because you really wasn't that bad. Now, this is hard to believe because a few months earlier, I was a no-good, dirty, rotten SOB alcoholic. And now I'm not that bad, you know. And she's standing in the doorway, and I'm having to kind of fight to get to a meeting. And she's kind of got my inventory. She's been working on my inventory. You know, I don't know if your spouse has ever done this, but she's got your inventory down. She says, you did this, and you did this, and you did this. And I was working on my four-step inventory, and when she came up for air, I reached in here, and I pulled out my inventory, which is on the back of a matchbook cover. Well, I didn't want it to fall into the wrong hands or anything, so I was keeping it close. And so anyway, I said, well, you left out a few things. And I can remember the look on her face. You know, it's like, what? You know, because I said, well, these are some more things that I've not done. And you could just see she didn't know what to say. She lips were moved, but then nothing's coming out, you know. And she walks off. And I'm going, yes, yes. AA is really working for me now, you know. It's like just those little subtle changes, you know. And if I would have got a divorce, or if I would have done the suicide thing, I'd have killed the wrong people. I'd have divorced the wrong people. Richard told me, he says, we don't know how to have relationships here. This is where we learn how to do that kind of stuff. Well, this is about quitting drinking. You bet. This is about quitting drinking. But what it's really about is living life sober. It's not about quitting drinking. It's about how do I live life comfortably sober? How do I get to a place where I can breathe in and out? How do I get to a place where I can deal with bankruptcy? How do I get to a place where I can deal with death? How do I get to a place where not only can I deal with those kinds of things, but I can do it with some kind of grace and dignity? And that doesn't mean that everyone's going to work. No, not at all. You know? We are sick, fallible people. Ain't some of us either. I loved what Jimmy Williams just said. There ain't none of us well here. Not one of us, you know. And if you think you're well, you're probably sicker than most, you know. It's an amazing deal here what we get to do. You know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had so many great things happen to me. One of the things that's kind of puzzling me here lately is I end up... I sponsor a bunch of guys, and I'm very fortunate in that because sponsorship to me is so, it's not about them. It's about what you do for me. You know, one night, Cindy and I was going to a meeting, and I got in the car, and we we developed a fight. I don't remember what it was about. We drove about 5 blocks to the meeting, fighting. You know, we were fine when we got in the car, so nobody else knew. I drive in the parking lot, and about 5 or 6 of my guys saw us driving in the parking lot, and they come over to the car and want to know what was wrong with me. I have a sponsor. Thank you very much, of course. That's the answer. But, you know, they nailed me. And it's that living in the glass house thing. It's like I've got to be – one of the things that always amazed me when I first got – the very first night in AA meeting, people were talking about things they should not be talking about in here. You know, and it's like, how can you do that? How can you try to be that honest with a bunch of people? But that's what we get to do. We get to try to be as honest as we possibly can. And I get to do that with those guys that I sponsor. You know, I remember doing a fifth-step inventory with a guy one time, and he was talking about burning his house down so his wife wouldn't get it. I understand that. I understand that. You know, that made sense to me. But I'd been sober for a few years by that time, and I was kind of shocked, and I can remember just kind of being put back by that. And then it dawned on me, I've been trying to burn my neighbor's house down for about 2 years, you know, so like I said, I'm not that sharp. I've been sober for a few years, and my daughter had started acting a little strange, and I mean, all the doors and windows in the house were starting to be broke, and Cindy said it's normal wear and tear, and I wasn't going for it. And we'd gone to one of those conferences where you had AA, Al-Anon, Alateen. And we was a big AA, Al-Anon, Alateen family. You know, we'd come back in. We just got in the house. It was about midnight, and I locked the door. I turned on the TV, said I was going to watch some TV. My wife and daughter go upstairs. And in order to go outside, you got to walk right past me watching TV. And the doorbell rings, and I go and answer the door. And there's this guy there, hair down to here. Hey, man, is Becky in? You know, and I said, no, she's not. Slammed the door. So I go upstairs to ask Becky who in the heck this is, you know. And so I go to wake her up, and it's just pillows. Yeah, you know, and I don't know why she wasn't like her father. But anyway, she had... one of her boyfriends had given her one of these chain letters that you can come out of a second story. That's why all the windows were broke, because she broke them. And that started a little journey for her. And she's been sober now in Alcoholics Anonymous for, I don't know what, 27 years? Yeah. And... I would have never thought that, you know, if they asked you to make that list that, you know, we're all, that imaginary list that we should make, that would not have been on there. I would not have had that there. I wouldn't have had the deal to be in here, you know, I wouldn't have had that in here. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life in such a way that I can't believe how good things are. And it's, you know, it's like our one day at a time story that we, you know, how do you stay sober? You stay sober one day at a time. Well, sometimes one day is a long time. Sometimes it's that 1 hour, that 5 seconds. And the reason it's, you know, at first I thought, well, that's cute. You know, I always kind of have this mind that's really judgmental. I know it's hard for you guys to believe this, but I have this judgmental mind, and I just, you know, come on, one day at a time. And an alcoholic is an illness. Alcoholism is an illness, you know. And I love that part that we read last night. The doctor's opinion says men and women drink essentially because of the lack of effect produced by alcohol. Yeah, I like the effect produced by alcohol. It says that they become irritable, restless, and discontent unless they can feel at once a few what they can with a few drinks. Killed that. Well, isn't that what I just described when I told you about my home group? That's irritableness and restlessness and discontent, and that's right, for me, that was right about 6 months. Now, don't get me wrong, I've had that happen time after time after time in Alcoholics Anonymous. My mind is out to get me, it thinks it can kill me and live, I guess. My mind is what we fight. It says, in the book, it says our main problem is centered in our minds. So that's why I have to keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous all the time to replenish my wrong, or get rid of my wrong thinking. It's important to learn how to live one day at a time. It really is. So there's my sponsor, Richard, used to say, I'd call him up with my crisis of the hour. You know, I don't know if you have any sponsees or that have a crisis every 15, 20 minutes, and this is the one, this is the life and death one, this is the one that's going to take me out, you know. And then you go, you know, you kind of, I'll take the red ones, you know. He used to say, okay, John, okay, shut up, just be quiet for a minute. I want you to reach behind you. I want you to grab your butt. I want you to grab your butt with both hands. He says, now, try really hard to bring your head into the same room that your butt is. Now, I know that may not be politically correct, but I'm going to tell you, it worked for me. So I sit there and I begin to realize how important being present is. And that's what I think we're trying to say when we talk about one day at a time, is being present. I am here, right here, right now. I don't know if you felt this, but when I go into a room of alcohol, when I was new and I walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't relieved of all that stuff that's going on outside. But maybe after 10 or 15 minutes, it began to go away because I began to be present and I began to listen to the person who was talking and I began to realize that what they were saying is things that was happening to me. So for me, I love what Vinoy said one time. She says, living under the God's umbrella is what really helps people like us. Because if I'm in the past, I'm worried about the wouldas and the couldas and the shouldas, all the things that I was supposed to, the guilt and the self-pity and the remorse, you know, the shame, that's all back there. Or else we can go the other way where we're living in the future and we're so stinking afraid that we're going to run out of money before we run out of life. Or we're going to not be able to have friends, or they won't trust, or, you know, just all these things that could happen in the future. So if I can live underneath God's umbrella, live in the now, live in the present, all of a sudden I have everything I need to live and live well. I live comfortably in the present. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, is the ability to be here now. If I can do that, then my whole life is pretty doggone tolerable. You know, I'm excited about seeing what shows up next, because have you ever got what you really wanted? How'd that turn out? You know, I don't know. Almost everything I ever really wanted and I got turns out to be a nightmare. And then everything that I thought was really bad that I got, I thought that was going to be just terrible. Well, it's not so bad. Fact is, a lot of things that was going to be really terrible, because of them, my life has been taken to such a place that's wonderful. You know, one of the most terrible things I can think of that's happened in my life was I have to go to A&A. Now, how's that turned out? And if you're new here and you're going, my God, he's been here too long. Well, maybe I am, but I'm going to stick around for a while because I really do like this. This is the most fantastic thing that's ever happened to me. By far, this has changed the way I live, the way she lives, the way my children live, the way my employees live, the way my employer lives. This is monumental in my life. So, I don't know. I'm really thankful that you guys asked me to come and talk. And Millie was right. I got to stay here long enough to start to see some miracles. There's a miracle right there. I know that miracle. There's some more, and some more, and some more, and some more. Just think, we get to come here and do what we don't want to do, and we get everything we ever wanted, and we don't even know what it is. Some of you new guys feeling disappointed that some of the old guys and gals are going to those secret meetings. Have you guys heard about the secret meetings? You know. Well, I got to go to one here the other night, and it's pretty nice. I heard something that might help you if you're new. And it goes like this. Them that go to meetings stay sober, and them that don't. Thank you.